The following takes place between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m.
I'm your Huckleberry.
Okay, you fellas ready to get going? Welcome, welcome, welcome to our little party today. Thursday, February 16th, 2012. Jason, I'll tell you what. You know, we got up to 1357 before we left the show yesterday. I thought those little boogers were going to break out to a new trading range, and bam, they hammered that thing.
Got knocked right back down.
Got knocked right back down.
So here we are again, once again, right in that 1350 range, 1346 at the moment.
Yes. So 1350 is clearly resistance, 1350 and change to be precise. We sit at 1346 at the moment. The S&P is up 3 points. That's a quarter of 1% to 1346.65. The Dow is up 0.4%, 57 points to 12,838. And what has been the leader so far this year? The NASDAQ. It's up 0.3%, 9 points to 29.25. The U.S. dollar is up 0.2%.
Well, the commodities this morning are in the red. Gold's off $13.50 an ounce to $17.14. Silver's down 61 cents to $32.89. NYMEX crude futures are off 0.25% to $101.57. We got a little bit of a mixed bag in terms of news headlines coming out this morning. The Commerce Department reported that builders broke ground on a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 699,000 homes in January. That's up 1.5% from December. And actually, that's the highest level being reported from the Commerce Department since October of 2008. However, the number of homes hit with foreclosure filings in January rose 3% since December. And that's another sign that the nation's huge glut of underwater mortgages and delinquent homes may soon start making their way into the housing market. Also, we saw the Labor Department reporting its seasonally adjusted core producer price index rising 0.4% last month. That's the largest gain in 6 months. And the number of Americans, according to the Labor Department, filing new claims for unemployment benefits unexpectedly fell to near four-year lows. The four-week moving average for new claims is now sitting at 365,250.
You know, if I were an incumbent president and I was dealing with the third year of a recession, I'd start manufacturing rosy numbers. I believe that's what they're doing. Now, we will give you the real numbers, hopefully tomorrow, no later than Monday. But we do have the real poop on the retail sales growth that they announced yesterday. Basically, they remain statistically insignificant, and they were reliant on price increases.
I think that's what you were saying yesterday, Alan.
Well, it was. I was giving you an example of units versus dollars. Both series, though, show a decline, perhaps confirming the somewhat overly optimistic nature of the hype surrounding the release of January's poor quality labor data. Reporting of both January retail sales and industrial production disappointed the market, despite them fluffing those numbers up, Jason. The monthly gain in retail sales was not statistically significant and otherwise what it was accounted for by price increases, not by increased physical volume of goods and services. January's headline industrial production was unchanged. Now, despite the downside revisions to prior retail sales reporting and an upside revision to the December production, year-to-year growth in both series has slowed markedly. Now, that's consistent with patterns that traditionally would lead into an official recession. Now, net of realistic inflation, both of those series still have been showing ongoing bottom bouncing following the plunge in activity. Economic activity we saw back in 2007 through 2009. Now, where the January retail sales indicated declining sales, January production showed surging auto assemblies. Now, this is an involuntary inventory buildup that's already indicated as the primary force behind estimated fourth quarter GDP growth. In other words, because of the way the Keynesians tally up that GDP number, as spurious and worthless and meaningless as it is, if people build inventory they really didn't want to build, that gets added to the GDP number. Now, traditionally, inventory excesses are adjusted when the manufacturers start cutting back production to bring inventory in line with sales. Now, nonetheless, recent reporting of month-to-month change in most economic data, and that includes payrolls, retail sales, and industrial production, remains of questionable quality due to the extreme distortions in the standard seasonal adjustment numbers. Now, keep in mind, these seasonal adjustments are designed to give you an annual number so that you don't see, I guess, well, take January, for example. We ended January with 2,680,000 fewer people working than we started January with, and through seasonal adjustments and other somewhat nefarious manipulations, we came up with a 243,000 job gain in the official number. Well, they use these seasonal adjustments for all of that. They've come up with a seasonally adjusted 700,000 housing starts. You and I both know there's not going to be 700,000 housing starts this year, but that doesn't seem to stop the government from reporting it as
well,
such.
Well, the models, is particularly with the seasonal adjustment, they make a little bit more sense when we have a stable economy. But the distortions that we're seeing right now, they're a direct result of the extraordinary depth and the length of the current downturn that we're in. This is unprecedented, folks, in terms of scope, in terms of disruption to the economy since we've seen post-World War II. So in terms of their models right now, they literally just can't handle presenting an accurate picture because they're not built to really fully account for the depth of the recession that we've been in since 2007.
Yes. All right. Well, that's it. We'll give you the actual numbers hopefully by tomorrow. Jason, did you see where the head of the World Bank, that guy Zolik, is stepping down, and none other than Hillary Clinton wants to take his place?
Well, that's a scary proposition.
Yeah, it is. Another scary proposition. This fella, President Obama's acting budget director, Jeffrey Zients, directly undercut one of the administration's key legal defenses of its Obamacare when they were, we're getting close to that Supreme Court case involving that. But when he was asked whether it was a penalty or a tax, he said, no, it's a penalty. But the Obama administration's argument, not the one they were arguing before the bill was passed, after it was passed and they realized that they might run into a little bit of problem calling it a penalty, they did start calling it a tax, because the way our laws are set up, they can tax us. They just can't penalize us for Obamacare. So this guy slipped up, called it a penalty. Now, talking about in love with the bankers, despite all that 1% and 99% and fat cats and all that, President Obama is going to return to New York, Jason, on March the 1st for a fundraiser with investment bankers and hedge fund managers. Now, that's according to a campaign invitation marking his first high dollar event since calling for increased taxes on the wealthy, $35,000 a plate.
I think it's very interesting, the dynamics of the elitist on the left that cater to the wealthiest of the wealthy, but at the same time, they seem to vilify anybody that has more than, X amount of income. So it's a very interesting dynamic here. We knew in 2008, Obama was clearly the candidate for Wall Street for the big banks. This year, it looks like that money might be shifting towards Mitt Romney, but Barack Obama still has tremendous influence on Wall Street and a lot of support there.
Obama, Jason, earlier this week actually pushed for what he was calling a global minimum tax. Now, think about that. White House economic advisor Gene Sperling announced his support for changes in the tax structure. Here's a quote. "We need a global minimum tax so that the people have the assurance that nobody is escaping doing their fair share as part of a race to the bottom, or having our tax code actually subsidized and facilitate people moving their funds to tax havens." So what Obama wants now is a global minimum tax. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, just looking at these words, a couple of them stand out in particular. We need a global minimum tax so that people have the assurance, government has the assurance that nobody's escaping this tax. That's what they really mean by that. The average person doesn't need assurance that somebody else is escaping taxes, but, you know, the assurance that nobody is escaping doing their fair share is part of a race to the bottom. That's a very awkward, weird way of putting it. We don't want people being able to escape the race to the bottom. That sounds strange.
This is Alan Butler. Jason and I will be back on the other side of the break. The Dow is up 61 points. The S&P is up 3 to 1346. We'll see you in a couple minutes.
That guy. I'm still hurting from last time you walked on this heart of mine.
Jason the Bamster was here in Atlanta. That would be one President Barack Obama. And he was doing an interview with one of the local TV affiliates, in fact, Fox affiliate WAGA-TV, right here in the ATL. And the guy that was doing the questioning was, you know, he was sympathetic. I mean, you could just kind of feel he was an Obama supporter. And he pointed out, you know, Mr. President, you've been getting pelted in the media for making a campaign promise that you did not keep, specifically about cutting that deficit in half.
That wasn't even a campaign promise. That was from 2009 when he made that comment. It was right at the beginning of his term. He said that by the end of his first term, he promised to cut the deficit in half. That was from 2009.
Well, here's the president verbatim. Well, we're not there because this recession turned out to be a lot deeper than any of us realized. Everybody who was out there back in 2009, if you look back at what their estimates were in terms of how many jobs had been lost, how bad the economy had contracted when I took office, everybody underestimated it. People thought the economy contracted 3%. It turns out it retracted closer than to 9%. We lost 8 million jobs in just 1 year span, about a half a year before I took office and a half a year after I took office. Well, here's my point. The reason people underestimated it is because the government you in charge of is deliberately misleading the people like they did today. John Williams at Shadow Stats pegged that 9% decline. The trough, as he likes to call it, was May of 2009. We got down 9%. Now the narrative, the official narrative, not counting the benchmark revisions that went unreported in our press, showed what, about a 3% contraction? And when in reality, it was 9%. And when they're saying they lost 8 million jobs, well, that wasn't the official narrative. The official narrative was, hell, we're at full employment right now. The reason you think everybody underestimated it is because that is what is coming out of the government.
Well, it's definitely hard to get a clear picture of what's going on when you have these numbers that are intentionally misleading the American people, these numbers coming out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that are coming out of the Commerce Department, that are coming out of the Bureau of Economic Analysis, that are consistently understating the true nature of what our problem is right now.
I would say not only understating, intentionally understating. I mean, how can a news media report 2,680,000 jobs lost in January as a 243,000 job gain? How can they sit there and tell you that we have inflation below 3% and it's above 10. That's the problem. And you know, and I want to talk, there was another thing on one of the local news stations yesterday talking about those greedy speculators once again for driving up the price of oil. To me, first of all, oil is going up because the dollar is going down. But blaming the speculators for the rising cost of oil is like blaming the Falcons' playoff loss to the New York Giants on the people who were betting on the Giants. The two really don't have anything to do with one another. So, anyway, the Greek economy spirals down as the EU forces final measures. Now, Greek default and probably a ejection from the euro moved a step closer night before last after the Eurozone finance ministers canceled, mind you, a crucial meeting accusing Athens of failing to flesh out austerity cuts. Remember, the EU wants Greece to cut so that they can have the money to pay back the banks.
Well, we've definitely seen political tensions over in Greece and over this Greek bailout growing over the last couple of hours. Yet another delay in this prolonged process to help Greece avoid a default in the short term has pushed things back again. The Eurozone finance ministers came out and said the decision to supply Greece with this 130 billion euro bailout will not be made now until next week.
Well, you know they're going to give them the money. Ben Bernanke's printing it up and handing it over to the ECB so that the ECB can lend it to the folks to buy Greek bonds so the bonds can be paid back to the banksters. That's what it's all about. And you pay for it at the gas pump and at the grocery store, but don't believe the numbers are telling you about inflation. Parents who borrow money to pay their children's college education, Jason, are currently exacerbating a growing student loan crisis. Parents are actually amassing far greater debts than the loans being taken out by the students themselves. Now, as we've reported before, we're sitting here looking at $1 trillion now in student loan debt. Now, parents at every income level are increasingly borrowing for their children's college education, and it doesn't matter where the parents are, whether they're low income, middle income, or upper income, there has been a dramatic growth in the percentages of parents who have been borrowing to pay for these escalating rates of a college education, rates that are escalating for no other reason than the government's direct involvement. They're not making college affordable for everybody. They're making it easier to go into debt. We've got a whole generation of kids coming out of college with a mortgage around their neck. My generation, we worked our way through school. No, I didn't. I went and started selling gutter guards after 50 hours, Jason, proud of it. But many of my friends, they worked. Actually, when I was in school, I worked. Either worked by day or went to school by night, or I did the reverse. But either way, I mean, you could have a car, you could pay for an apartment, you could pay for college and go out and have a little fun with your buddies. Now you cannot do that. Now your parents have to go in hock, or you have to go in hock, because the government is giving us cheap education. This student loan bubble is going to turn out like the housing bubble. And to that one guy, you know, we've gotten two negative emails, and all the time we've done all these shows, it came from the one guy, both of them. And when we were talking about the student loan bubble, he took it to mean we were anti-education. You remember that, Jason?
I do. Anti-college education in particular, which we're not. We actually support education so strongly. We think it's so important. We don't think that the government should be involved in creating these perverse incentives that are just driving up the cost of education, that are decreasing the quality of education, and are causing people like this. Parent loan debt, as you alluded to, Alan, has more than doubled over the last decade, over the last 10 years. There's something fundamentally wrong with the system itself. We're not against education. We're very upset right now with how the system is operating here in the United States. And this speaks to a larger problem, which is the debt problem, which is facing all Western economies right now. Europe is dealing with it in the immediate term. America is going to be dealing with it in the not-too-distant future. We are a society addicted to credit. We're a society addicted to debt. Our economy is addicted to debt. And it all ties back to this common theme, and the government policies are actually promoting people going into debt. They were promoting current consumption right now, seems to be the headline. They want to get consumer spending up. They want to artificially decrease interest rates to encourage borrowing, to encourage going into more debt. And this is all tied back to this same problem, that we don't have enough resources on the planet to honor these obligations of all the debt that exists on the planet. It's just right now it's not possible. It's not even possible to grow our way out of it. We have to reverse the trend of going deeper and deeper into debt. We're not going to get out of the hole by making the hole deeper. I can promise you that.
Well, just an example about there being more debt than there is money in the world to pay it. $1 trillion in student loans taken out by the students themselves, students that have no money. How are they supposed to pay it back? They're not going to be able to.
Especially with no jobs these days. And
Well, I was going to point out, for the baby boomers out there, Jason, I mean, our first mortgage was our first house. The kids that are coming out of school who had to borrow their way through school, they're coming out with a mortgage in student debt. How are they supposed to go out and buy a new house, buy a new car? It's tough. Tough times we're living in, and everybody's looking for a bailout. Nobody wants to take responsibility for decisions they themselves made.
Well, Moody's actually came out and said that they may be cutting the ratings of 17 global and 114 European financial institutions, and yet another sign the impact of this Eurozone debt crisis is spreading among the banks listed. I think it's pretty interesting. We saw Morgan Stanley on the list. We saw Goldman Sachs on the list, and we saw Bank of America on the list of possible downgrades coming from Moody's.
One of our guests, Charles Cadlick, he was Herman Cain's economic advisor. He penned an article entitled "The Federal Reserve's Explicit Goal: Devalue the Dollar by 33%. We're going to get into that on the other side of the break. The point I want to make, Jason, that's their stated value. That's not their intended value. Their intended value is to devalue it by some 80-something percent over that period of time. But we'll get into that on the other side of the break. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 64 points. The S&P is up 4.5%, 0.3% to 1347.77. We'll see in a couple minutes.
Back through the years, I go wandering once again. Back to the seasons of...
Part-time Atlanta resident, Elton John. Proud to have him as a part-time resident of our city, Jason. All right. You know, the banksters, the FOMC, they got together. They had a little cartel meeting a few days back. And then they announced their explicit goal to devalue the dollar 2% a year. That's a compounded rate of 24% a year. Well, hell, right now they're already running at 3.2%, even using their BS numbers. That you tallied at 37%.
So that's over a 10-year period is what we're talking about?
Yeah, yeah, compounded. Their goal is to devalue your standard of living. Their stated goal is to devalue your standard of living 24% over a 10-year period of time.
Right, that's their target.
That's their target. Their deliberate target. Deliberately trying to hit you with that. Because in their world, an increase in the price level of 2% in any 1 year is barely noticeable. Less, of course, you're on a fixed income. Now, the reality of their numbers is what would cost you $100 today would cost you $267 at the end of that 10-year period. If you accurately count the numbers. Now, they don't accurately count the numbers. They just discount the stuff that's going up. Well, that's what we call geometric progression.
Right, and one of the things that we have to keep driving home is inflation does not hit everybody equally. It doesn't hit everybody in the society, everybody in the economy equally. It is a very cruel tax because the folks that get the money first, the government contractors, the banksters, the very wealthy people who get access to this money first are the ones that get to benefit before the price levels increase. It's the people at the bottom of the chain that are really hurt by these price increases because they're paying more throughout this process, but they don't see their wages increase until much later on. And this is exactly one of the major contributors, this inflation caused by our central bank, the Federal Reserve, that is literally destroying the middle class here in America. If you want to know why the middle class is decreasing while we've seen a growing income inequality gap, it is directly attributed to the policies coming out of our central bank, the Federal Reserve, and this inflation tax.
The Fed zero interest rate policy accentuates the negative consequences of the steady erosion in the dollar's purchasing power by imposing a negative return on your savings. So think about this ruse they have going on. They've got these zero interest rates for their bankster buddies. And keep in mind, that's the rate that they're borrowing the money at. And you're getting paid, what, 0.75% on your savings? Meanwhile, the value of your dollar officially is declining 3.2% a year. You're already underwater, 2.5%. But if you take the real rate of inflation, the one they don't want to report to you, the one that surprised Obama when he took office, it was really a lot worse than people were telling him. I mean, you're losing ground. Your standard of living is declining by about 10% a year, unless you're getting raises at 10.3% last year. If you didn't get a 10.3% raise last year, you lost ground. Now, the FOMC judges that inflation rate at 2%, and that's measured by the annual change in their personal consumption expenditure, their PCE. That's what they're targeting now. And in their time, in their view, over time, a higher inflation rate would reduce the public's ability to make accurate long-term economic and financial decisions. Now, we all know what's going on at the gas station right now. It hits you in the face because you're buying one item and the number's right there in front of you for the 10 minutes it takes you to fill up your car. But the same thing is happening to groceries, to clothing, to the price of your sports tickets, to everything. And yet the official narrative is we don't have any inflation. That is what we call the inflation deception.
Right, now, and these economists, the FOMC, the Ben Bernanke's, the Keynesians, they really put a strong emphasis on the dangers of deflation. They think that at least having this small level of inflation is beneficial because it makes it less likely the economy will experience the harmful deflationary effects if economic conditions weaken. Of course, we know that there are very, very different reasons, very different types of deflation. For instance, if you look at the electronic industry over the last 20 years, you've seen prices continually go down, products quality go up. You know, are falling prices a bad thing? I would argue they're certainly not. If you have severe contractions in the monetary supply, which we saw at the onset of the Great Depression that were caused by the Federal Reserve, then that type of monetary deflation certainly was very, very harmful and threw the economy into a tailspin. But just to blanket a statement and say that falling prices in and of themselves are negative, especially during tough economic times, I don't think that that quite fits with the reality. When we have folks that are out of work, when we have folks right now who see their hours cut, see their wages cut, it might not be a bad thing to see prices at the grocery store or prices at the gas pump also fall to adjust to the economic reality of our situation and allow for our resources to be allocated where they need to be allocated instead of artificially propping up prices and really prolonging the economy's mechanisms for trying to heal itself from the damage done by government in the first place.
You know, what's nutty, Jason, I believe, well, first of all, I'll tell you one thing that's nutty. Their stated objective is a stable dollar. That's job number one for the Federal Reserve. And yet, you know, the dollar's declined 97% since the Fed sprang into being. And now they're sitting here telling you that their goal is to lower the value of a dollar 24% in a 10-year period. Think about that. How in the hell is that stable? But yet, that's their number one goal. And there those politicians are just going along with a ruse.
Well, no, if you just take the 100-year period before the Federal Reserve, the dollar did remain relatively stable.
And actually increased 5%.
It increased 5%. Well, that would be price deflation, right? That's a bad thing if you can buy 5% more things with dollars. But, 5% over 100 years, that's a pretty stable dollar. The second 100 years since we've had the Fed decreased over 97% of the value of the dollar. That's not quite as stable.
This mess we're in right now, this current quote-unquote financial crisis, the one the government's telling you is over, been over for, what, 6 months now? This was engineered in no small part by the Fed's efforts to stimulate the economy by keeping interest rates too low. And their whole quantitative easing, now all of that, it doesn't work. It doesn't work, but yet it's more of the same. Yeah, take a look at the most recent quantitative easing. That is a euphemism, by the way, for inflation creation or dollar destruction. But if you look at the results between November 2010 and June of 2011, the Fed tried to spur economic growth by monetizing $600 billion in treasuries. Well, what happened? What happened? Well, we'd been growing at a rate of 3.4% and slowed down officially even to 1% once the Fed stopped supplying all that cheap money. We actually saw a little bit of a recovery. The results are the opposite of what they say they're going to be. But what was his term for inflation? It wasn't transient?
Yeah, transitory.
Transitory, yeah.
Temporary and transitory effects of inflation. And yeah. Here we are coming up in summer of 2012, about to hit $5 a gallon at the pump.
Jason, the first airplane flight between Los Angeles and San Francisco took place this day in 1914. The U.S. Federal Crop Insurance Program was started in 1938. No, Fidel Castro, Obama's buddy down there, seized power in Cuba back in 1959 on this day. And what do you think of that?
I feel my heart bleeds for the Cuban folks down there, all the peace-loving, friendly people down there who've had an entire generation now decimated by a brutal regime under Fidel Castro.
You know, the Muslim Brotherhood over there in Egypt says that if we don't keep sending them that money, they're going to break their peace treaty with Israel. I'd call that a bribe or a threat or blackmail. What do you think? Also, Obama now, you know, Mr. cut the deficit in half and within his first term. I guess he implied he was going to get a second term. You know, he may, in fact. Nobody but the Republican Party could blow the opportunity they had this year. I would almost hazard to say we got another 4 years of the Bamster. But anyway, Obama wants to give raises to everybody collecting federal paychecks. Now, it's a modest raise, a half of 1%. And that would end his quote-unquote two-year cost of living freeze. Of course, they told you they had a two-year cost of living freeze. But what they did is they had those, step-up increases. We'll have to get one of our federal employees tell us how that thing worked. But during the two-year freeze, which Obama ordered in late 2010, eligible federal employees have received within grade step increases for advancing through levels of the general schedule pay system. Now, the Republicans have targeted those within grade raises, which average about $2,000 a person, as a way to cut federal spending. Only in the world of the federal government could a wage freeze result in the average increase of $2,000 per year per employee. But that is the government. Anyway, they also want to make workers pay more out of pocket for their retirement money. Now, keep in mind, the main difference between a federal retirement plan and a private retirement plan is those of us in the private sector, we have what are called defined contributions. Our contributions are defined. Our benefits are what we don't know about. Those, the variable, well, the federal pensions are just the opposite. Their benefits are defined. And that means if we have a horrendous stock market correction, doesn't really seem to affect those people. Affects us, but not them. Jason, I have a question for you. We'll get into the answer on the other side of the break. Now, we've had 19 resolutions to the Greek/Euro crisis. Do you think the ECB actually has a plan to rescue the Euro? Or you think this is all smoke and mirrors? Well, Jack Crook says it's all smoke and mirrors, and we'll get into that on the other side of the break. See you in a couple minutes.
He's an idiot. Comes from upbringing. Parents are probably idiots too.
Okay, Jason, this is by Jack Crooks. I sometimes agree with Jack, sometimes I don't, but he has a article he penned called, "Does the ECB Have a Plan to Rescue the Euro?" Now, ostensibly, it looks like old Jack's arguing for rate cuts. So I don't know if I agree with him, but he points out that, you know, everybody's constantly talking about how much the Eurozone needs to escape the economic mess that they themselves have created. So the big question has been, will the European Central Bank monetize the debt? Now, the charter that sprang the ECB into existence prevents them from monetizing the debt. Why don't you, first of all, just a little terminology primer. What do we mean by monetizing debt?
Well, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's taking the instrument of a central bank and buying government debt, and in effect, buying that government debt out of money that's created out of thin air by the central bank. So they are, in essence, printing money to fund or to purchase government debt securities.
Well, so the question is, will the European Financial Stability Facility, that's what they're calling the EFSF, be sufficiently funded as a bailout mechanism? And will Germany agree to start backstopping the periphery nations? I would argue that they should not. Did you see where somebody over there in the EU has now Angela Merkel painted out with swastikas and all because she's...
No, I haven't seen that one.
Well, I mean, like everybody, like most of our country, you know, everybody's wanting a bailout. Everybody.
So the questions here that you raise, there are three distinct questions. One, will the European Central Bank monetize the debt? And officially, probably not. It's not in their charter to do so. They still have an official mandate of maintaining price stability with the euro. They don't play the same political games with the European Central Bank that we play over here with the Federal Reserve. However, it should not be forgotten that the Federal Reserve is helping the European Central Bank, the ECB, to indirectly monetize the debt through these dollar liquidity swaps. The Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, is printing up dollars. They're trading euros for dollars. The European Central Bank is then allowed to lend out these newly created dollars to their banks in the European Union, their preferred banks over there, who can in turn purchase the government debt. So it's an indirect monetization of debt, if you will, to some extent. Will the European Financial Stability Fund, the EFSF, be sufficiently funded as a bailout mechanism? Well, that's probably a little bit more difficult question to answer. I don't know. Sufficiently funded is very difficult because the problem that we have right now is not a temporary problem that needs a temporary bailout. It's a fundamental structural problem with the way the governments in Europe are currently functioning. If you look at the debt in Greece, if you look at the debt in Spain, in Italy, in Portugal, this isn't a temporary liquidity problem. It's a fundamental solvency problem where these governments have promised far more in obligations, far more in promises to their people than they have in resources to pay them. And the third part of your question, will Germany agree to backstopping the periphery nations? Well, you know, who knows? That's up in the air. They've shown some resistance to it. But then again, it's not necessarily Germany agreeing to backstop the nations. It becomes a little bit more complicated because it's the German banks that are holding the debt of these insolvent institutions. So it's a very complicated political game. Again, we got the politicians and the bankers on one team, the people of these nations over in Europe, the citizens of America on the other side, and it is a zero-sum contest. Only one will win. If the bankers and the politicians get any of this money, any of this benefit, it's going to come out of the pockets of the people.
Meanwhile, the IMF wants to raise another $500 billion, and they're hoping the G20, i.e. the United States, putting up most of that money, they'll come to an agreement and make this happen. Now, Jack wonders why these other central banks are cutting their rates, but the ECB is not. You remember, the ECB's charge is price stability, not bailouts. But I'll tell you one reason I think they're all frustrated. The Germans currently are in the driver's seat right now at the ECB, and they remember the inflation of the Weimar Republic and the rise of the Nazis because of that. And as a result, unlike our folks, they seem to have learned their lesson. And I do not blame the German people for not wanting to bail out the other European countries. I mean, take people here in this country. You got a couple groups, people that live beyond their means, borrowed, had a high consumption lifestyle, the party's ended, and they're wanting somebody to bail them out. And then you have the other group that did the right thing and are riding the storm out. And yet the people that are wanting the bailouts are mad when people who did the right thing don't want to bail them out. This is a nation of whiners. That's what I'd say. I think Obama said that, didn't he? I'm going to whine about Obama a little bit today, but not right now. Jason, should sugar be regulated like alcohol?
I don't think that sugar or alcohol or tobacco or keep going down the list should be regulated by the federal government. I think there are appropriate ways to deal with it in the private sector. We have consumer advisor reports. We have a lot of other ways to regulate things that I would consider health issues.
Well, the reason I asked that, well, it was somewhat a rhetorical question. A new commentary published online in the February 1st edition of Nature says sugar is just as toxic for people as drugs, as alcohol and tobacco, and the government should step in to curb its consumption. The nanny state. The United Nations announced in September that chronic diseases like heart disease, cancer, and diabetes contribute to 35 million deaths worldwide each year. Well, so does aging, but we'll go on. The UN pegged tobacco, alcohol, and diet as big risk factors that contributed to this death rate. Old age contributes to it too, Jason. Maybe they should ban old age. What do you think? Two of those are regulated by government, alcohol and tobacco, leaving one, sugar. Well, sugar's not being regulated. So now they want to come in and regulate sugar. That's also helped to contribute to obesity, Jason, sugar. So much so that there are 30% more obese people in the world than there are malnourished people. So what, are they going to blame the fat people now for eating too many of the calories? The authors wrote that sugar meets the same criteria for regulation as alcohol because there's potential for abuse, it's toxic, and it negatively impacts society. Now, it's starting to sound like a little social conservatism to me there, Jason.
Well, it's all very, very intertwined here. The fundamental argument is something's bad. Something is bad in the sense that it's a vice. Something's bad that it's, you know, harmful to people potentially if they misuse it. Nobody's arguing that sugar's bad. They're arguing that sugar abuse is bad. So the solution for that, the simple-minded folks, the solution for that for the people that really like to meddle in other people's business is to have this big authority government use their strong arm and force other people to do what they think is right. Instead of using rational persuasion, instead of talking with people and trying to educate them about health risk and trying to use a lot of other social means that we have to influence behavior, they want to use the strong arm of government to force other people to behave the way they want. It's a bunch of, like you said, the nanny state, a bunch of busybody do-gooders that want to influence other people's life, control other people's lives, and it is just one example, but there are a myriad coming out from the left and the right of these people that maybe think that their intentions are good but want to control other people and how they behave, how they act through the force of government, basically saying that they can control and plan their lives for people better than these people could do for themselves.
The Sugar Association prepared a statement in response saying, quote, "We are confident that the American people are perfectly capable of choosing what foods to eat without stark regulations and unreasonable bans imposed upon them." And when they said that, I guess the folks on the left and the right booed them. That's just not the message these days, is it?
It is not, but we will come back with more of our message after the break. This is Butler on Business. Stick with us. We'll be back in a few.
The following takes place between 11 a.m. and 12 p.m.
I'm your Huckleberry.
Okay, Jason, as we enter this segment, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 55 points to 12,836. The S&P is up 4 to 1347. We're near the highs on the day, certainly well off the lows. You know, I look at Warren Buffett as almost the poster child now of crony capitalism. I mean, he certainly has himself in the right place at the right time when the government opens up its trough. But the old Oracle of Omaha the Cornhusker crony, is an astute investor regardless. And he pointed out recently that investments that are denominated in a given currency, and these include money market funds, bonds, mortgages, bank deposits, and other interest, are thought to be safe, but in truth, they are among the most dangerous of assets because while their beta may be zero, their risk is huge. Now, he points out that over the past century, these instruments have destroyed the purchasing power of investors in many countries. And really what he's pointing to, Warren doesn't like investing in bonds because it's the governments that issue these bonds at the sovereign level that determine the ultimate value of the money and therefore the effect that inflation has on the value of a bond. I have a friend of mine who is a bond salesperson. And he points out that the government will not default on its bonds because it can always just get the Fed to print up more money. And that's what Warren is also saying, just coming at it from a different direction. Even in the U.S., where the wish for a stable currency is strong, the dollar has fallen. And we like to point out 97% since 1913. Hell, it's fallen 86% since 1965, back when he took over at Berkshire Hathaway. And going back to that day, it takes no less than $7 today to buy what $1 did back in 1965. Now, consequently, a tax-free institution would have needed 4.3% interest annually for bond investments over that period simply to maintain the original purchasing powers, and managers would be kidding themselves if they thought any portion of that interest was income. And, you know, that is the notion. We talk about removing the taxes on gold and silver so that they can be used as money. What about the taxes on some of these taxable bonds? I mean, all you're doing right now, if you bought any of those treasuries, which, by the way, shorting the U.S. Treasury market is probably a really good long-term strategy in here where yields is slow. But just think about that. You're getting taxed for interest income that isn't even keeping up with the rate of inflation. That inflation tax is cruel indeed. In God We Trust may be imprinted on our currency, but the hand that activates our government's printing press has been all too human. That is from Warren Buffett. Now, let's get on to some violation of our rights. Now, you know the AMA, American Medical Association, they raised the ire of a lot of doctors by joining in recently to support Obamacare. Well, they are issuing a paper that proposed a law forcing people into experimental vaccine trials.
Right. This would be a federal law forcing each person to opt out of experimental vaccine trials if they would not want to participate. So you'd automatically be enrolled, and then you'd have to opt out if you didn't want to take part.
That has shades of what happened over there in Alabama, Jason, back in the day. That was a crime, and I don't think anybody really got prosecuted for that one, but that's what they want to do. This is a paper published by the American Medical Association's virtual mentor, wants to do just that. It seems that the amount of current participants currently in vaccine trials is a bit too low. So why not create a federal law forcing each person to either submit to these experimental vaccines or to opt out? So right now, your choice is to voluntarily opt in. What the AMA proposes is that you voluntarily opt out.
Well, this is a couple things going on here, along with the fact that you'd have to opt out of these trial vaccinations. You'd also be giving the big pharmaceutical companies a giant customer list now where each participant's information is going to be shared with the giant pharmaceutical companies in order to gather trial and field test data. Of course, this isn't anything that's too much different from how things actually operate now, where individuals are enrolled into these big pharmaceutical databases, even if you exempt your child from vaccination.
Well, where have we gotten to? Where even something like this, what was the Nazi doctor? doing all those experiments on there, folks. I'm trying to think of his name. But if Big Pharma can't produce enough positive data from those who actually want to volunteer for these vaccine trials, they'll just force people to participate or use a segment of the population that is ignorant to the laws and just make them participate. Now, what happens if these experimental vaccines cause harm? Well, guess what? They want to write in there immunity. So now you could be forced, if they get their way, you could be forced to participate involuntarily in vaccination trials and yet hold them immune if the vaccine doesn't quite work out as intended. Now, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986 protects vaccine manufacturers from any liability. Now, another example of similar medical, and I'd argue political tyranny is a document that was signed by Secretary of Health and Human Services, the former Kansas governor, Kathleen Sebelius, where both vaccine makers and federal officials were granted complete legal immunity from any repercussions, regardless of whether or not the case is valid. This was signed into law July of 2009 by Kathleen Sebelius. The document drew upon the provisions of a law that was created in 2006 for public emergencies, now granting swine flu vaccine makers legal protection and establishing a compensation fund. The legislation allows for vaccine makers to virtually disregard consumer safety. I mean, why not? I mean, if you're going to be immune from it, and if you can just start picking people that you want to subject to vaccine trials, and if they were unaware of it, which most people are, that they could have opted out, then you're automatically opted in. They do this experiment on you. It goes awry, and you have problems. You know, I did get it at Zicam. You familiar with going on with Zicam? You know, they used to have the little gel that you'd put in your nose, and it was frying people's olfactory nerves. We had a listener that put some of that nasal spray in her mouth, and it blew out her olfactory nerve. She can't smell anything. I want y'all to be careful not to use that anymore. Zicam. You use Zicam?
I have in the past. I have in the past and have luckily not had any problems with it, but I will be careful going forward.
Well, I think you should be. We've got Ileana Johnson. She hasn't been on with us for a couple of weeks. We got her coming back on. She's our modern-day on-ran. What are we going to be talking to Ileana about, Jason?
Well, we're going to be talking to her about a couple things. Obviously, she's been a frontline reporter on the perverse impacts of UN Agenda 21. That's whenever you hear sustainability, green energy, a lot of these themes, they tie back to this UN Agenda 21. She's been on the show several times before talking about that. She has an interesting experience that she recently saw at Washington's Reagan National Airport. We're also going to be talking to her just in general about the U.S. economy, the directions of where things are going, and what happens if we continue down this path of pursuing socialistic policy. She spent her young life in communist Romania, so she has a pretty good perspective of how the other side works.
And we've got Chris Merola coming up after Ileana Johnson. This is Alan Butler. We've just been graced by the presence of a celebrity here, the voice of our traffic, Chris Monroe, coming in, I guess, to do a segment with us. This is Alan Butler. We'll be back on the other side of the break.
Welcome back to Butler on Business. My name is Jason Riddle in the studio with Alan Butler. Alan, while we have a few minutes waiting on Ileana, I thought we could get into Obama's budget a little bit.
He came out, obviously,
with the new budget projections, new federal budget projections. It includes a range of accounting maneuvers to cast the administration's 10-year projections, obviously, in the best possible light. But George W. Bush did the same thing. So I think that that's why we have to look at President Obama's spending numbers for the current year, next year, what he's done already historically, and spending's gone up $2.98 trillion in 2008, or since 2008. That was the year Obama came into office. Now it's up to $3.8 trillion in 2013. 28% increase in just 5 years represents compounded annual growth of about 5%. And what's interesting about this budget, and we'll get into this more later on in the show, but as we see stimulus going down, the spending going down, as we see the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, all these other global wars he seems to be putting us into, spending for that is projected to decrease over the 10-year period. Recession-related costs projected to decrease, falling by hundreds of billions of dollars. Yet he's using this money to increase spending in other programs. So we've run deficits now greater than $1 trillion for 4 years in a row, and there still just seems to be absolutely no sense of urgency for real spending cuts.
Ileana, how you doing today?
Good morning. I'm wonderful. How are you guys?
Well, it's good talking to you. Now, on the phone with us is Ileana Johnson. She taught economics as a college professor for 30 years. She writes frequently for the Canada Free Press. She recently published a book about her 20-year experience in communist Romania. Echoes of Communism has been about 3 weeks now since you've been on the show.
I know. I've missed you guys.
Well, we've missed you.
It's good to hear your voice.
All right. Now, you want to talk about the economic state of America today and where we're heading if we don't reverse these socialist policies like Daniel Hannan over there in the UK. He says, we are your future. Look at us. I guess Romania is the future of the UK's future, the former communist Romania, that is.
Absolutely. Former. The prime minister in charge now is the chief of secret police, so you decide.
Uh-oh, in Romania? Or are we talking Putin?
We're talking in Romania, yes.
Well, that seems to be going around then, because isn't Putin former head of the KGB?
Yes, correct. It's kind of scary, but you be the judge.
I actually have friends that live in Russia, and there's some civil unrest going on over there. Putin's not a well-liked figure, and they think the election was jerry-rigged.
That's usually the case in the Eastern Bloc countries recently. They bribe people with walking money or walking bribery, so to speak, right before voting.
Sounds familiar, like free condoms.
Well, usually it's food there.
Condoms over America. I wonder if they're going to airlift those things in.
I don't know. It's strange. Speaking of airlifting, they actually had to drop bales of food over villages in Romania because nobody would come out to shovel the snow. They're still waiting for the nanny state to come shovel the snow.
Now,
and I'm not trying to speak badly of my people, but so many years of communist rules installed certain mentality, and it's hard to overcome that.
Well, it seems like that mentality is, I mean, to a lesser extent, becoming more and more ingrained in our culture now. Ileana, we've got a recent report showing that over 1 out of 5 Americans are now dependent on one form of federal subsidy or another.
That's correct.
Totally dependent on one form or another. We got 148 million receiving one form or another.
And those coincide strangely with the 48% approval rating of the president and also of those who are who do not pay taxes. So it's kind of interesting. And almost half of all Americans under the age of 30 do not have a job. And among college graduates, 25% of them are unemployed.
I don't think you're allowed to say that.
I'm not allowed to say that?
Okay, no. I mean, it's full employment.
Yeah.
All right.
Sure.
No inflation.
No inflation whatsoever.
No. Those half of the people.
We just exclude food and gasoline and everything is hunky-dory.
And those half that don't have jobs under 30, they don't want jobs. They're not willing and able. They don't count them anymore.
Yeah. They're totally discouraged.
Yes. All right. But go ahead.
Well, speaking of that, we have approximately 13.1 million unemployed Americans, and we're not quite sure if that's an accurate figure because they keep massaging the data every time they report it to benefit the administration. It seems that we're creating less jobs, more people are out of work and discouraged, but the unemployment rate is going down.
Well, they're counting 13 million. I think they're mailing out just south of 30 million unemployment checks each month.
Yeah, it's still pretty scary, but hey, we now are exporters of oil. Apparently, we're exporting 4.9 million barrels a day. Not barrels of oil, but gasoline. We're exporting gasoline. So that's kind of an interesting development. We have not exported gasoline in 62 years. So that's interesting. And probably, as I reported in my article, people are kind of scratching their heads. We're exporting gasoline. Demand is down. And,
Prices are up.
Yeah, and car prices are up. What gives? Well, first of all, we are at the mercy of the OPEC countries, which are a cartel, who collude on the price per barrel of crude, which is around $100. Of course, they're keeping the price artificially high, and there is a recession. We have fuel-efficient vehicles and higher prices. We use ethanol as ingredient in gasoline. That causes a higher price in corn. As a matter of fact, I traveled recently, and I found in the brochure on the plane, the CEO of this particular airline that I shall not name was touting the fact that his airline started using biofuels. And although they're not as comparable to hydrocarbon fuels, anyway, he was proud of the development, and I was thinking, I wonder how that factors in the reduced food supply and the high price of corn and the riots all over the world when people couldn't afford to buy their staple food.
Eliana, you've been on a number of times talking to us about UN Agenda 21, and you when you went through Reagan National Airport the other day, it hit you in the face. Could you tell the listeners who may not have heard you previously, what is UN Agenda 21?
Well, it's kind of an insidious plan by the United Nations going back 30, 40 years to curtail our economy, to de-develop us, so to speak, to reduce our use of land, to confiscate our private property, and basically stack us in little neat high-density urban areas while they take the land and give it back to nature. And they are doing it all in the name of protecting the environment and Mother Earth, because we've been very, very bad humans.
Well, you recently in Reagan International, you saw a sign, "Welcome to a sustainable city." Now, to the average person, a sustainable city might not sound like anything to get alarmed about.
Exactly. Most people would think, well, that's a good thing. You know, we're recycling water, we're reducing congestion. But to me, it's another kind of buzzword of Agenda 21. So I stopped, and it was a huge electronic billboard. People thought it was an advertisement, but it was actually a game, a touchscreen game, and it was supported by Zeeman Corporation. And when I captured with my iPhone the actual website, and I put it in my article, they were talking about sustainable development, green buildings, intelligent buildings, smart grid, sustainable urban development, sustainable communities, environmental care, health care, and all of these are buzzwords for UN Agenda 21. And there were actually three games, and I could only stomach playing one. There was the Green Building Challenge, the Urban Mobility Challenge, and the e-car charging challenge. And in the urban mobility, it invited the player to put as many people as possible in trains. And if you fail to do it in a time period, the streets overfilled to capacity with cars and you lost the game. I was so disgusted that I didn't want to play the other two, because to me it was an obvious attempt to put as many of us into trains and take us out of our cars. And of course, the e-car part had to do with using the electric cars that we know nobody wants to buy, and they don't take us very far. And we found out recently through a study that they're not that eco-friendly either, that they actually contribute to pollution even more so than gasoline.
Well, I think that that's probably one of the major points in any type of economic analysis. You have to recognize trade-offs, and you also have to recognize some of the consequences that aren't as readily visible. And when we talk about things like sustainability or even green or protecting the environment in the light that we're talking about today, it doesn't mean that we're against the environment. It doesn't mean we're against, you know, cities that are sustainable in this, in the normal way that people might use the word. But when you start forcing these type of regimented government programs that fit a very specific agenda, a very progressive agenda, then I think it raises some questions.
Yes, it does, because it is true that we have had some bad environmental disasters or mistakes. And because we have advances in technology, that has helped us clean up our act. And in a few cases, we've actually invested the resources to actually clean up some of the worst damage that we have caused. The perfect example of this is the so-called worst environmental disaster, the BP oil spill in the Gulf. Do you remember how everyone was screaming that it had ruined the area for generations? Well, guess what? The damage is virtually all gone, and I'm not afraid to eat shrimp or fish from the ocean, and thanks in small part to human effort. But for the most part, is due to the oil-eating microbes and algae that Mother Nature put there just for this purpose. And actually, our air is quite clean, even though the environmentalists complain that it's filthy. Do you remember the almost constant grayish-brown blanket of pollution that hung over the valley where Phoenix and Scottsdale, Arizona are located? Well, we found out later that it wasn't really pollution, it was dust. And even our air traffic leaves no statistically significant amount of pollution in our skies, and CO2 is not a pollutant. Plants need CO2. The other more noxious parts of the jet exhaust, for example, are so small in relation to the Earth's atmosphere as to be, in my opinion, meaningless. Of course, I'm not a scientist, but I have read a lot. For example, one volcano burp puts more pollution into the atmosphere than all of our aircraft do combined in an entire year.
Ileana, you mentioned that oil-eating bacteria. There's an outfit out in Texas called Fritz Industries that cultivates that stuff. They actually got started making bacteria to jumpstart koi ponds. And I recently bought some of their bacteria to jumpstart a new koi pond I put in. And did you see the Star Wars movie where they had that Genesis device and they launched it into a dead planet like Mars and then there was life?
Yeah.
Well, this bacteria, I told them it jumpstarted. It was almost like overnight. I'm seeing everything change. It was quite novel, but they got into cultivating oil-eating bacteria through there wasn't enough people willing to pony up $300 a gallon to put the bacteria in the koi pond. Jason knows a fella that was stupid. Well, I wouldn't say stupid enough. It jump-started that filter like you wouldn't believe, but that's actually a little thing I didn't know about. That is their business model, cultivating that bacteria, and the stuff is quite expensive, and I wonder how much money BP spent. I know I spent $300 pouring a gallon of that into my koi pond. They must have spent millions of dollars dumping that bacteria into the Gulf.
Probably. I don't know. I haven't seen the data, but it's possible. It's plausible.
Well, I think I can call those fellows up and ask them, just how much business did you do with those folks 2 years ago? They may or may not tell me. They're nice folks, though. Hey, yeah. Listen, it's been a pleasure. We look forward to having you on next week. That sound like a plan?
Yes, wonderful. Thank you, guys.
Well, it's always a pleasure.
Until next time.
All right. This is Alan Butler. Jason and I are going to be back with Chris Marola. We're going to talk about politics here in a minute.
Love so much, can't count all the ways I die for you, girl, and all they can say is, he's not your kind.
Okay, old Green's gaining a little steam there, Jason. up 84 on the Dow. Up almost 8 points on the S&P. We sit slightly above that 1350 resistance level. We're at 1351.04, or whatever strength, as minor as it was in the U.S. dollar, has deteriorated. The dollar is now down on the day, which means that gold and silver must have come up a hair. But I'll tell you who's going to come up a hair here in a second. It's my buddy Chris Marola.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
You still love me after our email exchange last night? I was getting on those Republicans in the emails last night, Jason.
Well, yeah, I don't mind your emails. I just want you to know that the majority of the Republicans in the House didn't vote for that budget compromise, that it took almost a party-line vote, almost all the Democrats, and only a small handful of moderate and center-right Republicans to pass that budget. The majority who are more conservative didn't vote for it.
Okay, so let me ask you, though, that a lot of this legislation, you know, Boehner, like Harry Reid, the Republicans in the House have offered up some austerity, and Reid won't allow it on the floor, but then we got Boehner doing the same thing. I mean, Boehner can control what votes come up and what votes don't, and Boehner, their leader, is who negotiated the compromise. Why don't they just get rid of Boehner? I mean, first of all, almost all of these politicians, I like them all as people.
Right.
I mean, I even feel sorry for Mitt Romney since he's losing so badly in his home state right now. I'm not going to vote for him, but that doesn't mean I don't have empathy for him. But Boehner, who I like, you know, he's a chain smoker, by the way, but he... You know, they need to just get rid of Boehner and McConnell. That would make me happy. Put in somebody like, you know, DeMint in the Senate and put in, you know, somebody that's fiscally conservative in the House.
Right. Well, that would have to be up to the people in the House and Senate to make those decisions. They have to vote for those positions. But I think what really we have to really discuss is how the game has been, in a sense, rigged to be a big spending situation. The Democrats had control of the U.S. House for 40 years. And in that time, what they did was so destructive that, I mean, it would probably take another 40 years to undo it. I mean, look what LBJ and the Democrats gave us with baseline budgeting, or sometimes called zero budgeting. It's a mandate now that every time the federal government gives money to a program, a department, or to an agency, or even just to a college, university, that all of that budget has to be zeroed out, has to be completely spent in order to get new money the next year. I remember at college watching at the end of the fiscal year, it was a running joke among those of us at college, and we used to become so fed up with it. Getting close to the fiscal year, the university would spend all of their budget, what was ever left, on the most frivolous, useless, most ridiculous things. Every year they'd build a statue somewhere on campus that no one really cared about. Every year they would, you know, put money into some really ridiculous monstrosity of an, you know, art-looking, a very artistic, abstract-looking piece of art somewhere on the opposite end of campus. It was the dumbest thing, and we knew that this was because of baseline budgeting. They were wasting their budget so they could get more money next year. All of these things are kind of, you hate to say it, on autopilot, and it's going to take a generation to get rid of them. So we can't expect Republicans overnight to make a difference, especially if you've got people like Harry Reid in the Senate tying up the good legislation that the Republicans in the House are forwarding.
Chris, you bring up an excellent point, and I think that just that example, that's just such a small microcosm of a much bigger, more fundamental problem, and it really is a structural problem with the system itself. Even if we had the right people in there, it would still be very difficult to rein in spending because of all these wasteful, basically, incentives that are built into the system right now.
I tell you what, I can feel my dad channeling me. He, even though he's not with me right now, he wants me to point out, and I'm getting ready to do it for you, Dad. When he was in charge of procurement for the U.S. Army, their mission wasn't to save money. It was to see how much money they could spend.
Yeah.
All right. Now, so that points out what you're doing. And then one time, the squadron that does the in-air fuel refilling for our military, one of those squads is up there at McGee Tyson Airport, Knoxville, Tennessee. You know, I go up there frequently. And periodically, towards the end of the fiscal year, which happens to be in the middle of football season, that's how come you can see them, they're sitting there flying overhead, just circling and circling. And one time I asked one of those fellows when he got on the ground, y'all practicing touch and goes, you know, landing and takeoffs. He said, hell no, we're burning fuel. I said, why are you burning fuel? He goes, because we got some fuel left over, and if we don't burn it all up, we won't get the same amount of fuel next year.
Yep.
That's what
budgeting is, right?
Yeah. Well, all right. Got that out for you, Dad. I want you to know he was in charge of logistics for not only keeping Patton supplied during his march across Europe, but also for the Pacific Theater with MacArthur. But later on, in peacetime, he was in charge, so he tells me, basically on whizzing away as much money as they possibly could, which brings me to Dr. Ron Paul. He draws a distinction between military spending and spending on defense.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm glad to hear that your father had something to do with helping and MacArthur, because it was Patton's 3rd Armored Division that landed in Italy and ended up liberating my parents and their town from the Nazi occupation that almost cost them their lives. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the 3rd Armored Division liberating my parents when they were children in Italy from the Nazi occupation of their town and saving their lives and making my life possible. So 6 degrees of separation. Indirectly, your father had a hand in helping liberate my parents and making my life possible.
Well, I like his stories of trying to keep the communication lines open, that Patton was moving so fast they had to start raiding all the copper wires and everything they could possibly get their hands on to keep those lines of communication open. But I do know whenever the conversation turns to matters of government spending, he always likes to point out that their mandate is to see how much money they can whiz away.
Right.
All right. So now bringing us back to our email exchange last night, all spending originates in the House. All they have to do is not raise the debt ceiling. If they didn't raise the debt ceiling, bang, we had to live within our means. And that was what was so frustrating for me.
Sure, and I understand that. All my point is, and no, I don't take anything you say personal. As you know, I emailed you in return, said I respect your frustration. I'm equally frustrated as well. But looking at the big picture, once again, there are a lot of conservatives. There's anywhere between 100 and 150 members of the Republican Study Committee who are the Reagan Republicans in the House, and they're good people. People like Mike Pence, you know, people like Paul Ryan and others, you know, who vote our way. The problem is, even though 150 is a large group, it's still not the majority. And the rest tend to be a little more moderate, can easily join forces with the Democrats. And so the only way we're going to stop that is when people like you and Jason, who are libertarians, join the Republican Party and elect more conservative Republicans in the House and Senate so we don't have as many moderates.
Well, I'll tell you, the guy I'm proud of is Jim DeMint.
Absolutely. I agree.
I mean, we asked him if he would run for president, and he said no. He would not subject his family to that, and he didn't see the president looking back at him when he looked at himself in the mirror. And that's the kind of guy you want. Jim DeMint, I think, has it figured out. We are in a fiscal crisis. That's what we got to worry about right now.
Yeah, and Marco Rubio as well. I would put him right behind there.
Well, I was proud to vote for Marco Rubio. I vote in the state of Florida. I told Jason Marco Rubio was the one guy I was anxious to vote for, and vote for him I did.
Awesome.
Well, Chris, it's been a pleasure. We'll have to keep it going tomorrow. I wanted to talk to you about what Senator Ron Johnson had to say about the Obama administration, but let's get into that tomorrow.
That's another good one, Ron Johnson. Now, he came out of the private sector.
Yeah, and that's why he's so effective. Yeah, let's talk tomorrow about Ron Johnson.
All right. Good talking to you, Chris.
You too.
Bye. This is Alan Butler. Jason and I will be back on the other side of the break. We're going to get into a little bit of history. Exactly what that is, we'll let you know when we come back. That I've learned.
most valuable commodity I know of is information. Wouldn't you agree?
Waiting for the lyrics. Okay, it keeps you running. I'll tell you what wasn't running. It's the economy. Back in 1873, the panic of 1873, listen up. On February 13th, 1873, one can probably say America began a death spiral into depression. Silver prices in February of 1873 were immediately depressed, and now they were starting to float freely based on market forces and not government rules. And this is because of an act passed, better known as the crime of 1873. It was the Coinage Act, and it took all silver coins out of circulation, thereby reducing the money supply, which in turn raised interest rates. Now, if this were a normal economy, this wouldn't have been too big a deal, but this wasn't a normal economy.
Well, the crisis of 1873 closely resembled some of the prior crises. We saw expansion that was initiated in the United States due to the high cost involved with things like the Civil War. We saw the railroad network dramatically enlarged in iron and steel industries. They underwent intensive development here. We also saw expansion spreading through the rest of the world and Europe. It was a tremendous time in stock market speculation, which in turn spurred the industrial sector in terms of purchasing industrial sector securities. And we saw an artificial expansion that led to speculation, which seems to be the theme in a lot of these crises.
Yeah, it was. In other words, an enormously overheated economy with tons of paper currency floating around and not enough gold and silver to back it up. Uncertainty abounded regarding the silver market because of the crime of 73, the Coinage Act, and credit was drying up because of rising interest rates, and the railroad boom was in its last stages. Now, in the previous years, there had been a minor shock. The Black Friday panic of 1869, the Chicago fire of 1871, there was an equine influenza 1872, and then on May 9th, 1873, the Vienna stock market crashed, signaling the beginning of what in Europe was known as the Long Depression. And this depression in Europe, again, it began in 1873. That damn thing didn't end until 1896. That was, in fact, a rather long depression.
Yeah, it was. And again, I just want to reemphasize here the role that the expansion of the money supply, the artificial expansion of the money supply, plays in these crises. We saw it in the most recent financial crisis here in the U.S. We see it going all the way back to the panic of 1873. If you look at the total state and national banknotes, the paper money, that rose from about $835 million in 1865, just after the Civil War, to $1.964 billion in 1873. That was an increase of 135%. Or an increase of about 17% per year in the amount of state and national banknotes.
Well, in late 1873, Jay Cook and Company, who was a major U.S. bank at the time, was heavily invested, as many other investment companies and banks were at that time, in railroad companies. I guess you could say they had a railroad bubble. Right at that time, they were all trying to get more capitalization for further expansion, but President U.S. Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, instituted a monetary policy of money supply contraction. Now, Jay Cook had been working on a project for years to create a second transcontinental railroad called the Northern Pacific Railroad. That one you did this story on, Jason. That was an excellent piece you did, by the way. Ground had already been broken in 1870. And in September 1873, Jay Cook, in face of Grant's monetary policy, tried to sell millions of dollars in bonds to finance the project, and he couldn't. Even though they were about to get a $300 million government loan, O.J. Cook's credit became worthless, and he was forced into bankruptcy on September 1873.
Well, he was one of the creators of the national banking system during that period. He was also the monopoly underwriter of U.S. government bonds for every year except for one between 1862 and 1873. And he did engage in this railroad speculation and somewhat an example of poetic justice here. The overbuilt Northern Pacific Railroad was crumbling. We saw Cook's government bond operation also proved to be a failure. So his house went crashing down, and he ended up going bankrupt. But he was a big financial player in the day as well. So that bankruptcy really touched off the panic of 1873.
Yeah, and what happened, just like when Lehman Brothers today failed. There's just one right after the other started failing. And obviously the impact was felt very quickly in New York, more slowly in Chicago, and slower still as you move west. But the results were certain. Lost jobs, increasing unemployment, and bankruptcies. When it was all over, the country's 364 railroads, 89 of them went bankrupt. This is back when they used to let businesses fail. But a total of 18,000 businesses failed between 1873 and 1875. Unemployment reached 14% by 1876, 3 years after the Great Depression began. And we're talking about that one. And so 3 years later, the lingering 14%. Now, unemployment peaked here at 10.4%, if you believe the official narrative. But back in 1873, during that depression, construction work halted, wages were cut, real estate values fell, and corporate profits vanished. I mean, by all standards, this was a terrible depression. It was deep, it was wide, and it was long, 12 years long. Just think how that would go over in today's political environment. While there is probably nothing that could have been done to prevent a strong economic downturn, if the intelligent minds had prevailed instead of the political ones, they would have been out of that one like we were in the one in 1920. I always argue it's a shame Bernanke was not a student of the 1920 depression, because the one that we inaugurated in 07 would be over with by now. But instead, he was a student of the Great Depression, and that one lasted for many years. Jason, what won't last for many years is today's show. We're out of time. And the market is kind of on the highs of the day. The Dow is up 104 to 12,884. The S&P is now up 10 points, 0.7% to 1353. This is deja vu all over again, Jason. This is about where they hammered that market down yesterday. Buyers stepped in based on those bogus government reports that came out this morning. And I guess for today, we're not going to worry about the Eurozone. So the party is on up there on Wall Street. We'll just have to see how long it lasts. Our show lasts no longer today. This is Alan Butler on behalf of my co-host, Jason Rendell, and our producer, Mike Roy. We'll see you tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.
Quitting time! Quitting time!
That's all, folks!